The elimination of evil. The elimination of evil.
Brother Ray, the Lord be with you.
In fact, Bill, we'd like to emphasize the word, the elimination of all evil. Our scriptural basis for this subject is Revelation 19. It's verses 11 through 21. And in verse 20 and 21, we're told the manner in which all evil is to be eliminated, or it will end. The manner in which it will end. It reads, "And the beast was taken with him, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, which he deceived them that hath received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into the lake of burning, or of fire burning with brimstone. And then the remnant were slain," and so on. Now, we'd like to also read Revelation 18, verses 21, because it also describes the very same event. It says, "And a mighty angel took up a stone, like a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall the great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all." In both of these chapters, we're told just how the enormous, overpowering system known as Christendom will be eliminated. In about 800 B.C., God spoke through his first prophet. The prophet's name was Joel. And then, for the next 500 years, God continued to speak through a prophet. He spoke through someone that he selected. There were a lot of others that claimed to be prophets, but he spoke through the one that he selected. And through each one of those prophets, God let it be known how disappointed he was with humanity. Now, we realize that man, in falling down this broad road to destruction, we realize that man didn't have to do such a good job of it. You know, man in falling, he didn't have to fall so hard. And not only that, what didn't have to take place was papacy. You know, there didn't have to be an Antichrist system so devastating that it made nighttime, or it made darkness right here on earth, so intense for 1,000 years that historians called that period of time the Dark Ages. Well, before that happened, before the Dark Ages set in, God prophesied that it would happen. And not only that, God told us how he felt about it. So, as early as 800 B.C., God started to talk about this disaster. He told of his disappointment, because, as we said, it wasn't compulsive that papacy should reign and dominate the world in order to teach the lesson of sin. You know, in the days of Noah's grandchildren, Babylon started, or it first took shape. Nimrod was the instigator. He set the example of a mighty hunter. And then he regimented society, and he set up idol worshiping on a massive scale. Society quickly changed at that point into leaders and followers, and it just continued to get worse, generation after generation. God permitted this enemy of his to develop from that small beginning. God chose not to destroy it, but rather he allowed it to happen. It eventually developed into the universal kingdom of Babylon, whose capital site was right on the river Euphrates. Now, this world power that even captured Jerusalem, which is to say Israel itself, this universal power was just a picture, only a picture of a kingdom that the risen Lord told the Apostle John on the Isle of Patmos, that it would rise up out of the sea in about the 6th century. The risen Lord also told John that he, that is the risen Lord, would be the one that would take charge of the process that was going to eliminate this final form of Babylon. Now, the way the risen Lord told John the process would be initiated is Revelation 11:15, when it says, "And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdom of this world is become the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." Now, when that seventh trump sounded, or when the Lord's second presence began, or in the year 1874, the kingdom, or the world itself, became the risen Lord's kingdom. Now, what did or does the returned Lord do with this kingdom that became his? Well, God himself, through the prophet, tells us, gives us this answer in Daniel 2:44, when it says, "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all of these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." Now, the moment the risen Lord returned, or began his second presence, and he interposed in world affairs, that started a war. The old order has got to be torn down. The new must be established. Now, what's very seldom taken into account in the consideration of this war is the manner in which this war is fought. You know, it's fought in a series of battles, battle after battle after battle, until the final battle actually takes place. Now, when this struggle is over with, and everyone is going to be able to look back, and they're going to be able to review what took place in this battle after battle after battle until the final battle, well, only then will the superiorness of divine wisdom be realized. It will show just how all-encompassing the Lord's strategy is and was. It will also show how flawless divine justice is. You know, when everyone realizes this, well, then at the same time, they're also going to realize that the Lord, besides being just and flawless in his justice, he is also righteous. Additionally, he is merciful and he is loving. So as we say, from the moment the risen Lord took possession of the world, a war began. The war is made up of several battles. Each battle takes place in order to tear down the present order, or to do as we're told in Revelation 2:25, when it says, "And he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father." Well, what really happens each time a battle takes place is man is endeavoring to make adjustments to his social order. Now, for whatever reason or purpose he makes these adjustments, it seems that history just repeats itself. And so a man tries again. Well, what we quite often say is happening is that man is sort of haphazardly endeavoring to pick himself up by his own bootstraps. And when he gets all tired out trying to save his own social order, well, then God's going to take over. Well, this is only partially correct. It's only partially right. Man does have to first try and save himself. Also, when he reaches the end of his rope, he will ask God to straighten the situation out. But what's most critical to also keep in mind about this battle after battle war is the risen Lord is the general of Jehovah in this warfare. And what the risen Lord is doing as the general of Jehovah is, he is directing and controlling the affairs of mankind so that they actually use all of the good things of the kingdom. They actually use everything that increased knowledge produces. You know, they're actually able to use all of the chemistry, all the elements of the earth. They're even using the physics of the universe. The general of Jehovah is letting mankind use everything that he himself will use when the meteorial rain takes place. The only trouble is, mankind is using everything incorrectly. And this is what is taking place in every battle as the conflict goes on since 1874. No one, absolutely no one in the kingdom is going to say that if we had the same tools, you know, if we had the same chemistry, the same physics that the King of Kings is now using, well, we could have done likewise. Well, they won't be able to say this because they did have equal opportunity. Man's greatest problem is, while he is able to use everything that is good, as we say, he uses it all incorrectly. Man takes all of these elements out of the earth, and what does he do with most of them? He just fabricates tons and tons of toxic waste. He upsets the ecology of the earth, and he pollutes the air with his nitric and sulfuric emissions. You know, it is man's selfishness. It is his greed. It is his avariciousness that is causing his self-destruction. Man is going to be brought low. He is going to be humbled. Now that's going to be the turning point after which he will start his walk up the highway of holiness. Now in the book of Revelation, the risen Lord tells us how, or he tells us the actual course that he follows in order to bring man around to this very point wherein he can walk up this highway of holiness. And that course is laid out for us in the 16th chapter of Revelation. It is the pouring out of the seven vials upon the earth that gains this objective. And when the seventh vial is poured out, well, then you're going to have a condition that is described as a mighty earthquake. It is so great that Daniel describes it saying that there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. Now, that trouble, we are told, is the death knell for Babylon. In the strictest sense of the word, it is the destruction of Babylon itself that includes the failure of all the nations in the world. Now, as we said, the Lord tells us, he told John, he tells us through John, and he did this ahead of time, he stated that Babylon was going to rise up out of the sea. And from that small beginning, that system would grow. And it became so great and so powerful that it was given, or the beast was permitted, to have power over all kindreds and tongues and nations. Now the beast is also termed a woman, a queen. The system was considered to be God's house, considered as God's temple. The reality was, of course, the only thing the woman did as the house of God was to make all the earth drunken with her wine. And so therefore we're told the nations are mad. Now this papacy, which made war with the saints and overcame them. Yes, overcame them. This system that made all nations mad, this system will be destroyed in God's own due time by the returned Lord as the general of Jehovah. Now there are other missions the returned Lord is accomplishing during the period of his return, and one of them is Revelation 3, verses 15 and 16, when it says, I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would that thou were cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Now the risen Lord in 1874 returned for the purpose of setting up his kingdom. But before that could happen, the glorified Lord's own bride class, the group that would work together with the risen Lord in destroying papacy, well, this group has to be made complete and be joined together with their Lord. Well, what this means is they have to be harvested. Before that could happen, they had to first leave the church system or the temple group that the master spews out of his mouth. And so we have the condition of Revelation 18:4 when it says, And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Now after 1799, papacy had her teeth taken out. All of them. She was also defanged. I wouldn't exactly call her a house pet at that point. But she didn't have her power anymore. Even though everyone's still afraid of her, and the reason being, they're all still drunk. But nevertheless, Babylon was fallen after 1799. She received a body blow, and she no longer would make war with the saints. Now the Lord of the harvest told the saints, when he returned, to come out of her. And then he would serve them meat in due season. The returned Lord also said that he personally would enter in and he would sup with them and they with him. Now what's most critical to keep in mind about the rather massive exodus that took place under divine guidance, under the guidance of the Lord of the harvest, is the fact that every single individual that came out of a nominal denomination, they didn't come out of one denomination just to enter into another denomination. What took place the moment after the risen Lord returned for the purpose of calling his saints out of Babylon is the Lord of the harvest gave a general or a broad call to leave Christendom. Now the Lord directed each one that responded to the call, the Lord directed them, as we say, not to enter into another denomination. Rather, he directed them to the location where he could sit down and sup with them. The Lord of the harvest directs each individual to the environment that corresponds to where all the embryo new creatures that existed in the days of the apostles, or as we say, in the days of the early church, it's where they dwelt. And this location was in an ecclesia. Now, an ecclesia that functions properly, it's a segment of the literal body of Christ that exists and is going to exist for all eternity on the other side of the veil. Well, after being drawn to this location on this side of the veil, it enables each one then to be begotten of the Holy Spirit. To be Spirit begotten. And then as stewards of God, each one is able to use their one lifespan up in copying Jesus and in doing God's will. During the harvest, it is the will of God that the seeds sown for the stars of heaven segment of the Abrahamic covenant, it is God's will that this segment should be brought to term. The Master himself, over and over again, referred to the period of time after 1874 as a harvest time. In the harvest, the wheat would be taken to the barn. The tares would be bundled up into bundles and burned. Now, just to accomplish both of these facets of the risen Lord's return, to do these two facets, it required a totally different function by all the called out spirit-begotten new creatures. It required a different function from what all took place during the age itself. What was required was every single individual was to be committed to be united with all other footstep followers. They were to be united with them in a work. In a work that not only would finalize the gathering of the very last grains of wheat, it would also serve the purpose of holding very high the standard or the banner of God's truth, the banner of God's doctrines. Now, this standard, this banner of God's doctrines, this is what the Lord of the harvest is using in his judgments of Christendom and of all the nations. Now, the banner of God's doctrines exposes the error, the sin, the selfishness in the present evil world. And the Lord of the harvest requires each one that is separate from Babylon, the Lord requires that they be personally dedicated to individually and collectively do this work, to do witnessing work, to do public witnessing work that's necessary to distinguish truth from error. Now, this public witnessing work is to continue in the harvest period, not until we feel, you know, we're getting a little bit too old now to be doing things like that. Rather, this work is to continue until the last saint passes beyond the veil, or until the nighttime comes wherein no one can work. And you know, that can fool you. I was reading a little bit about this, about those in Romania that thought that that nighttime came in on them for about 15 or more years, and then they got a reprieve. Now, you know, there might be a difference of opinion. There just might be a difference of opinion by some in the household today, right now, relative to the importance of being a part of this united effort of holding up this banner and so on. Or at least there can be a question of just exactly how much personal energy should be expended by us in public witnessing. In fact, some question the value of any effort at all being expended by any of us at all. They say, actually, no one even knows you're alive, let alone to pay any attention to what you're saying. We're told by these individuals that the effect, that the small chirp that you and ones like you are making in this world of over 6 billions of people, well, the effect that you're having is something like taking a cup of water, you know, pouring it out into an ocean, and then saying that's going to affect the water level of that ocean. Well, our answer to all of these different forms of scoffing is just keep in mind, no one, absolutely no one, could be more alone and reduced to a mere whisper than what Jeremiah was. And yet he publicly held up the banner. Now, what makes all efforts put forth here on earth to bear witness to the truth, whether it's Jeremiah's efforts or it's our efforts, what makes all of these efforts worthwhile is the fact that God, in His divine providence, is blessing
these efforts.
He is coordinating these efforts. He is supervising them to serve His eternal purpose. So thus, the witness that God wanted to be given during the complete harvest time has been given. This same witness is still being given. And it's going to continue to be given until that last vial is poured out into the air. The seventh vial, which very well could be a public witness message over the airways. Now this message that is continually given by the called out ones during the harvest, this message is an exposure of sin and evil. It exposes Satan as the father of all lies. This message also includes the reality that all evil shall be eliminated. As we said, Revelation 19, verses 11 through Revelations 11 through 21, it shows the Lord of the harvest riding on to eliminate all evil. To destroy evil, one must completely destroy its source. Now that's Lucifer. That's the old serpent, the devil. When the risen Lord returned in 1874, He returned to a condition of wickedness running rampant. Now, as we said, the Lord's return marked the beginning of a harvest. He was the Lord of the harvest. One segment of the harvest work has been Psalms 50, verse 5. Gather my saints together unto me, those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Now, another segment of the harvest work has been Zephaniah 3:8. Therefore, wait ye upon me, said the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. The risen Lord, as the general of Jehovah, is doing all of this work. This work was prophesied by God Himself from about 800 B.C. to about 300 B.C. After Malachi, God stopped talking. Then God's Son took over. And especially in the book of Revelation, the risen Lord tells how all evil will be eliminated. You know, if man wants to destroy something, what he does is he takes a bomb and he drops it up. And if that isn't enough, he gets two bombs. He might even take a hydrogen bomb, but he just keeps banging and banging away. God doesn't work that way. When God's general destroys or eliminates all evil, the sinner will not be destroyed. Not one sinner will be destroyed. Only the sin itself will be destroyed. Even Satan himself is going to be put into a pit for 1,000 years. Of course, he will get destroyed after 1,000 years, along with anyone else that is incorrigible. But during the time of the Lord's second presence, the sinner does not get destroyed. In fact, during this period of time, he is learning lessons that is going to benefit him for all eternity. Man, in his frantic effort to govern himself and to save himself from destruction, he's failing, and he's failing so thoroughly that the memory of this failure is going to be an everlasting lesson for all creatures, great and small. Right today, man is in his darkest hour. Now, we keep hearing brethren saying, Jacob's trouble. Well, before that grand and awful time that God fights for Israel, as He did in days of old, before the bow of Gog is smitten and all their arrows fall out of the right hand, before Ezekiel 38:20 takes place, when it says, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the field and the creeping things that creepeth upon the earth and all men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. Well, before this, Revelation 18:21 has to take place when it says, and a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, and he cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down. Now, the one thing we are not trying to do is to give any assurances like, well, don't worry, there's not going to be any changes yet. Maybe not for a long time. We're not saying that everything that is important is still future. You know, we haven't seen anything yet. That would be wrong. Even as Peter says in 2 Peter 3:8, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Now, all things are not continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. We heard a very wonderful explanation of that in the previous discourse, of how things are changing, and changing fast. You know, what could take place any moment from this day forward could be Isaiah 47, verses 8, 9, and 11. I'm going to read that. It says, therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasure, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am, and none else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children, but these two things shall come to thee in a moment. In one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon thee in their perfection, in the multitude of thy sorrows, or in the multitude of thy sorcerers, and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. Therefore shall evil come upon thee, thou shalt not know from whence it riseth, and mischief shall fall upon thee, thou shalt not be able to put it off, and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know. Now, this tells us just exactly how quickly what we read in Revelation 18:21 could happen. You know, once that stone is lifted up into the air, dropping it doesn't take very long. Now, just how long did the breaking of the Berlin Wall take? Now, we'd like to bring out another point, because we feel that Revelation 14, verses 17 through 19 will likewise take place. The vine of the earth, the product that Satan controls, will be cut down. It's going to be cast into the great winepress of God. You know, it is the Lord of the harvest that treads this winepress, even as it's told to us in Isaiah 63:3, which we won't read. The significance of the master trotting this winepress alone, trods the winepress alone, well, the significance of it is to show that the master, not man, is personally in control. He is coordinating everything that takes place in order to have the destruction of sin, and at the same time he has the redemption of the sinner. Now, most likely, as that great millstone is cast into the sea, the merchants, the ones who personally have profited from Christendom, well, at this point they're going to lament. Now, we don't know how long they're going to lament, because the angel with the sharp sickle, he thrusts his sickle into the grapes of the earth, and you have Ezekiel 38:20, wherein you have all men upon the face of the earth shaking. Now, there's a point, brethren. There's a point in time where all of these descriptions of trouble, they really come together. And there is going to be the final battle. There will be the final lesson in alienationship from God. And after that final event, man is going to have Psalms 46, verse 9, when it says, "He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow, and he cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariots in the fire." And only God could be so kind and loving. Now, in all of these activities that the Lord of the harvest has been engaged in and is still continuing to be engaged in, there's one gem that seems to stand out above everything else. And it also is a product of the harvest. Or at least, it literally can be seen and identified because it was harvested by the Lord of the harvest. And that gem is Revelation 14, verses 4 and 5. I'll wait a half a second, because to me, that's the icing on the cake. It reads, "These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from amongst men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne." Now there it is. If you want a description of who the called, chosen, and faithful are, well, this is that description. You know, what's described here is the little flock. Pure as the wind-driven snow. It's the 144,000. Now, each one of us, we have our own special way of being thrilled by reading these two verses, I know. For me, every time I read them, I say to myself, you know, right now, there are 6 billion of people in the world. There's always been hundreds of thousands of people on earth. For centuries, there's been billions of them. From generation to generation to generation. And yet, only 144,000 properly follow the Lamb. To follow the Lamb properly means correctly knowing the Master. It means truly, accurately knowing the Master. Now, I've been praying to properly know the Lord for over 50 years now. And I'm still praying. I must know Him as completely as possible before I can fully and properly follow Him. It's the intensity. The intensity has got to increase and increase, even though I've constantly been a follower. Well, to be without guile, it isn't as simple as it sounds. You know, you can be a little flippant about this. Having guile, being deceitful, this is something that all of Adam's children are inclined to do and continuously have been inclined to do ever since the time of the flood. Having guile also means being cunning. Now, most everyone feels that it's kind of a compliment to be considered by others that they're cunning. Having guile also means being crafty. And just about everyone kind of smiles with contentment. They have a literal grin from ear to ear when it is felt, when it's considered that they were cunning. Or rather, I should say, when they considered
when it's considered that they were crafty. They were manipulators, maneuvers. You feel good about it. People feel good about being crafty. Well, one thing is certain. The master wasn't crafty. And the master wasn't cunning. Nor was there any treachery in him. And I think to myself, now just how many of us can close our eyes and say in our own hearts, and the same is true of me. The harvest itself is going to end. And when this harvest ends, so will evil end. And after evil ends, what's going to be brought into existence is going to be the bride of Christ. It's going to be in full vision without literally being seen. It's going to be the virgin class that has no guile. And then after that, when the kingdom work is going to be over with, and everyone will be raised to the mark of perfection, well, there won't even be any guile found anywhere here on earth. Nothing deceitful, nothing cunning, nothing crafty, no treachery is going to be found anywhere in the universe. May the Lord add his blessing.